first I landed in Liverpool, I went upon the spree. With money at last, I spent it fast, I got drunk as drunk could be. And it's when me money was all gone, it was then I wanted more.
Okay, I'm Richard Schiff, the general manager at Acme Smoked Fish in Brooklyn, New York. And I'm sitting down today with Joe Brownstein, Robert Caslow, and David Caslow, three generations of the Acme Smoked Fish family. And we're going to try to talk about our history in the smoked fish business in New York. And with that being said, I'm going to start it off with Joe Brownstein. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Joe, when did you first start in the smoked fish business?
When I got out of the Army in 1946, when I actually started. Prior to that, when I was going to Hebrew school across the street from my father's smokehouse, my first job was cleaning out the charcoal pots for 5 cents.
Who's your father?
Harry Brownstein.
And what is his connection to all this?
He's one of the original principals at Acme Smokefish.
How did he get involved in the smoked fish business?
When he arrived in this country, his brother, who was here before him, had somehow or other became a jobber selling smoked fish.
What is a jobber?
A jobber is a distributor of smoked fish from the smokehouse to the individual stores that sell the consumer.
Go on with your story. Harry was a jobber.
His brother said to him, get yourself a horse and wagon, go to the smokehouse. You can get smoked fish on credit. After you sell this fish, you'll pay for what you bought.
And who was he buying smoked fish from at that time?
I'm not aware of that.
Okay.
Which of the smokers? We're talking now in the 20s. It's a little before my time.
Okay. So in the 20s, he was going around with a horse and wagon.
He got an automobile and
okay.
a truck.
All right. So he's going around distributing smoked fish, and at some point he becomes a smoker. How does that happen?
It was the ambition of almost every jobber to become a smoker. Several jobbers would get together. They would each put up $2.50. They would find someone who knew how to smoke, and they would start a small business. There were always smokehouses around. I don't know why, but there were. Since they all had some business, they had a going business from day one. My father was interested in one of these things for several times, three that I remember. They all went busted. Sometime in mid-30s, he became partners with a jobber, and there were just the two of them, and they were a success. That was the Banner.
It was called Banner Smoked Fish?
Correct.
Who did he become partners with?
Man's name was Mike Seltzerman. He was also a jobber.
Okay. So they teamed up and started this Banner Smoked Fish. They were now smoking.
Right.
Successfully. Were you involved in the business at that time?
No.
When did you come along?
1946.
And was the company still Banner Smoked Fish at that time?
Yes.
Okay. And what were you guys smoking during that time?
Well, not quite what you smoke now. We were smoking salmon, kippet salmon. Carp, sable, butterfish, chubs, whitefish, eels, of course, various types of sturgeon, or did I say that already? We were not smoking whiting at the time, because at the time there were a string of backyard smokehouses along the Jersey Shore. They specialized in smoking whiting only, since they caught them along the Jersey Shore.
Mm-hmm.
They would all went out of business courtesy of the FDA.
So
after
even then,
1963.
So even then, the FDA was putting a lot of these guys out of business.
The FDA discovered the smokefish business in 1963 when there was a botulism incident associated with chubs and whitefish smoked in the Midwest.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Joe, can I just ask you a couple questions about salmon, if that's okay? You said that you smoked salmon in the 30s and 40s. It's not the type of smoked salmon that we know today, correct?
Very apropos, your question. The question on Richie's list, he gives you names of salmon, smoked salmon. And one of them is lox. To my mind, first of all, lox is a German word for salmon, spelled differently, of course. The salmon were mild cured on the coast in these barrels. They were sent east. When we got them here, we would string them up, but they were dangling in running water. We were leaching them to remove most of the salt. And then they were smoked 10, 12 hours. At the time, of course, there was no air conditioning. I remember going to a smokehouse in the summer. It was so warm. I heard the salmon flopping, falling to the floor, but they insisted on smoking it. That's what I consider lox. At the same time, the salmon that were caught, the wild salmon that were caught off the East Coast, Canadian, Nova Scotia, Labrador, those were cured in the individual smokehouse. Mixture of salt and sugar, various formulas. That's the recipe they used in Europe. They did not make lox in Europe. They made what we consider Nova. They called it smoked salmon, period. Scottish, Irish, the word lox. Why does lox apply to the salmon? Believe it or not, the salmon swam up almost all the rivers in Northern Europe, a major one being the Rhine. And the German, when Julius Caesar gave us the name to those salmon, he called them lox, leaping salmon, leaping fish.
Wow.
When he got to the Rhine. So there's, the history of salmon goes way back then. One of the questions Robbie asked me was, how come they smoked salmon in New York? And I said they smoked salmon in New York before the first settlers. The Indians smoked them out west. That was one of the ways of preserving the fish.
I assume that's the same reason they salted the salmon in the West Coast.
Correct.
And sent it east, so that they could preserve
just
the product.
Just to preserve it.
And it was coming over in rail cars during those
yes.
times? So on the way, it's curing on the way. It gets to New York. It's being soaked to get some of the salt out. And then being smoked.
Correct. There are almost no novies.
So, David, today you're doing something different with this lox that's coming from the West Coast.
Right. Today we're selling it really as a salted salmon, which is different from smoked salmon, which we're accustomed to eating now, which is done the way it was done on the East Coast, which was fresh salmon was caught. It was sent directly to the smokehouses where they were able to cure it and smoke it. You could make a milder product out of that. It didn't have to be salted so heavily. Again, from the West Coast coming east, you had to salt it. There was no freezer. There was no refrigeration. So we're talking in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s. It was the only way to preserve the product. So the product was salted, shipped, and just like in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s.
But there was a trick to that also. You wanted to salt it enough to preserve it, but you didn't want to make bacala out of it, which is what the Portuguese and the Spanish did when they were fishing off the Canadian coast. They would catch the fish, put them in a hold, layer of salt, another layer of fish, a layer of salt, another layer of fish. That was pretty much the entire ship was like a barrel where the salmon were curing, except that they were using cod.
So how is that different from the lox that was made in the West Coast?
That is called mild cured.
The idea is less salt there than a full salted product.
It was cured in salt and water, there was a process for the first that took about 8 to 10 weeks from the time they went into the barrel. If you open the barrel after 4 weeks, they would be flat as a board. But that's because the salt drew all the liquid out of the salmon. The additional liquid made the contents of the barrel, it reduced the reading on the salometer. It was no longer 100%. It was less.
And so that's what made it mild, was it right. wasn't 100% salt solution.
It started out 100%, but afterward it was not.
Right, you mix it with the water that comes out of the salmon and you get a
process
less concentrated.
Osmosis.
Right.
So the product...
And after 4 to 6 weeks, the salmon began to swell up, reabsorbing the water that was there.
Right.
So the end... On the LOX product from the 40s and 50s, were people calling it LOX back then?
Yes.
Everyone was just... No one was calling it Nova. Everyone was just calling it LOX.
Completely different animal.
Okay. And today, Rob, people are using the term LOX. They're using the term Nova. It's like a catch-all phrase.
Right. Your customers call and order and they say, send me some LOX. But they're referring to Nova Scotia-style salmon, which is a milder salmon.
Right. So in the 40s and 50s, was the taste preference for that saltier, or that was just the only thing that everybody knew?
The only game in town. I shouldn't say that. The supply of Canadian Atlantic salmon was relatively limited. Always was. This was wild.
These are wild Canadian salmon.
And they commanded a premium. When you used LOX, if you soaked it enough and you smoked it, you were pretty close to the product that they produced, that we could now refer to as Novi.
Right.
Not quite, but almost.
So during your entrance to the smoked fish business, what was the landscape like in Brooklyn and in New York in general? How many smokers were there in your neighborhood who you were competing with?
I would guess 12. It depends what you call my neighborhood.
The metropolitan area, let's say.
At least 12.
Can you remember some of the names?
Well, we were discussing one before. Century Smokefish down the block. We came down the street. We passed Ten Eyck Street. There used to be a Ten Eyck Smokefish. Occupied the plant that Marshall later took over. At the time, Marshall had a place elsewhere in Europe. There was, of course, Vita. Oxenberg Brothers. Did I say Montrose?
Not yet.
Joe, what about Horowitz? Was Horowitz around?
Horowitz was a major smoker. And, of course, Banner.
This is you at that time.
No. You said, yes.
There was another. Because there's a Banner smoked fish today.
I realize there's one now.
But this was still you and your father at that
time.
Who else were you and who was from your family was involved in that business?
No one.
So you were the first of his sons to come into the business?
Yes.
Okay. And then who came after you?
In the Banner, no one.
Okay. How did Banner become Acme smoked fish?
My father had several heart attacks, and he retired. And I continued working for his ex-partner. And I believe it bothered my father that I was working for his ex-partner. When this place, 30 Gem Street, became available, this was probably a year or 2 years after he retired, when 30 Gem Street became available, he put in a bid with the landlord, and he got the lease. my brother, myself, and a fourth party whose major interest was on the West Coast. Name was Julius Fishbein. But he remained partners with us only for 2 years. He was disappointed in us. We lost too much money.
I assume he
when he was... left, Ruby came in.
And Ruby is who?
Ruben Caslow.
Ruben Caslow is my father.
Which would be Joe's brother-in-law.
Right. Okay. So then you guys all decided, let's start this new business. We're going to call it Acme Smoked Fish. And you bought 30 Gem Street, which
we just bought the lease. We didn't own the building.
Right, okay, you took the lease. How big was 30 Gem Street at the time?
Not big. Maybe 30 or 40 by 100.
Oh, wow. And today, 30 Gem Street has expanded into...
I don't know, maybe 60, 65,000 square feet.
From 30 by 100. Amazing. And in that 30 by 100 space, you were curing fish and you were smoking fish, packing fish. How many people worked at 30 Gem at that time?
Let's see. A smoker, helper. One smoker, a helper, a driver. I had one packer who packed the smoked fish. And maybe 3, 4, 5 wet workers.
Mm-hmm. What's a wet worker?
He prepares the fish to put into cure and puts it into cure.
Okay.
Prepared meaning clean it, cut it, depending on the type of fish.
Richie, I just want to chime in here that Joey was referring to the number of people or employees he had. He left out that the owners performed many, many functions at that time, and their day was extremely long. So they were doing office work, they were doing packing, they were doing cleaning. It was just a really extended day, as we know it today.
So I was going to say, so it's really no different than today. The owners of the company are doing all the things you just described, and that's what makes the smoked fish world go around.
We always felt it was a hands-on business.
Yeah. So who were you selling fish to at the time?
Jobbers.
Only jobbers.
Exclusively.
Okay. So
that means Acme didn't have any trucks. They didn't make any deliveries. And technically, they didn't have any customers, right? The only customers were the distributors or jobbers who came in to pick up.
Right.
So do you remember any of the prices you were selling fish for back in those days? What did a pound of lox go for in 1954?
The year we started, there was supposed to be a slight shortage of frozen salmon. And the going price in the industry was $125 a pound to the jobber.
That's not an eighth of a pound. That's a whole pound.
Well, there were always some smokehouses who reduced the price slightly to increase business, which... if they reduced it 5 cents, would make it $1.20. Julius said to us, they're not going to come to you unless you give an inducement. If others are going to sell at $1.20, you have to sell at $1.15, which we did, and it worked out. Because we didn't make any money.
And that's why your partner on the West Coast was not too thrilled with you guys back then.
Well, part of the reasons.
All right. So, Robert, when did you come into the business?
I was just talking to Joe on the way over here, and I was reminding him that I was still in high school in the summers, and Joe would drive by to my home. I didn't have a license yet, and he would pick me up and bring me into Acme. Joe reminded me that my first job was to weigh the what we call melon lugs. Before we had corrugated boxes, we used to pack the salmon in wooden boxes, and I would weigh the wooden boxes to see what the tear would be. That was my first job. After college, that would be June of 1970, I came in full-time.
And what was Acme like in the early 70s? How did the size change from this 30 by 100? Were you expanded a little bit beyond that at that point?
Yes. By that time, my dad had joined Acme, and Joe and I, we realized it was a year or two after Acme was first born that Ruben joined the company. Now, he brought some direct business, which means he sold directly to stores, which Acme at that time was not doing. So there was a distribution business that was part of Acme.
So he was a jobber before coming into the
Correct. The he was also was a jobber, business. And he had these group of stores or small supermarkets that he sold.
So we're going to backtrack a little bit. Ruby really was instrumental in changing the way that Acme did business. At the time he came in, or before the time he came in, they were only selling to jobbers. Ruby being a jobber, he had this book of customers, and they needed, or Acme needed, a way now to go deliver this product to the customers. So
what you're saying is accurate, but misleading.
Correct me.
The entire conditions of the entire industry changed. When the day of the jobber was over, when going back then, there was a grocery store on every corner. And the grocery store sold smoked fish, sliced it himself. The only thing he kept in the refrigerator was the milk, refrigerator, icebox, milk, cream, butter, nothing else. There was no room, which meant that the jobber had to deliver smoked fish daily so that it wasn't laying around too long. With okay. The advent of the supermarket and refrigeration, that was no longer necessary. In addition, over a matter of time, these 5 and 6, 7 chains, store chains, got bigger, and they didn't want to buy from a middleman. They wanted to buy direct from the smokehouse. That was the end of the jobbers.
So now you've got a customer who's got 7 stores, 10 stores, and they call you up and they say, I want you to deliver all these stores.
They don't come to
And they don't need it every day.
You have to go for them.
Okay. So, Robert, when you got into the business in the early 70s, tell me about the size and the scope of what you were doing then.
So Joe said we had, we were about 30 by 100. We expanded to a second building, but still we were under 10,000 square feet at the time. The side of the business that I worked on was really the side of making the orders and seeing that the orders got out on the few trucks that we had at that time. Also, in the early 70s, we started slicing salmon into 3-pound trays, 5-pound trays, and consumer-sized packages.
Okay. So you were taking some of the bulk work that the storekeepers were doing and doing it for them in-house.
Correct.
And you said you were doing some small packages or more just...
No, we were doing small packages. We were doing 4-ounce packages, overwrap, not what we do today, but more of what you might see the supermarket does in their self-service counter today.
Like a saran wrap style.
On a foam tray, like
right.
You'd get a chicken on today.
I don't think it was foam. It was
foam.
It was a solid plastic. It wasn't styrofoam.
Originally, Joe, it was the styrofoam boats. And then from there, we went to more of a firmer plastic. We did start with the styrofoam.
I remember the plastic.
Yeah.
That you forgot to say you were actively involved in the slicing department.
Yes, I was actively involved in the slicing department. A total of four or five people who worked in the slicing department when I first came in.
And we're reminded of that frequently.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, there could be one or two of those individuals that are still working in our slicing department. So in total, how many employees did you have during that time?
In total, we had, I would guess, about 30 people in total in the early 70s between drivers and Joe described the wet workers and packers. But again, we were running a 24-hour business. This was 6 days a week. Saturday was a busy day, and Sunday at that time was still we were still send out a few delivery orders on Sunday morning.
What was the delivery area like?
The delivery area was the greater metropolitan area. We really didn't go too far into Jersey, nor did we go too far past Yonkers in the north. And, you know, it was a trip to go out to, let's say, Smithtown.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I remember it, I don't know if it was in the 70s, possibly a little later, but my description was we delivered every place a truck could go up and back in one day.
That's true.
But we cheated from that.
Right, we cheated because we started very early in the morning. Right.
I think we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back and we'll talk more about smoke fish in a little bit.
Walking down London Road, and I met with Rapper Brown. I asked him if he'd take me in, but he looked at me with a frown. He said, last time you was paid off to me, you chalked no score. But I'll give you a chance, and I'll take your advance, and I'll send you to sea once more. Once more!
All right, I'm back with Joe Brownstein, Robert Caslow, and David Caslow from Acme Smoked Fish. And we've been talking about some of the history of our company and smoked fish in general. Robert, we're going to jump right back in and continue talking about the 70s. And Acme, you just described the delivery area. When did you sort of jump out of that New York local market and start getting your smoked fish out to the rest of the country?
I would guess we started distributing outside of the general New York area the late 70s. We found a large kosher distributor in Baltimore area who we've been very successful with over these years. We also started to find some shipping customers using common carriers, refrigeration, airplanes, where population changes. People were looking for smoked fish from Brooklyn.
When did you start going to Connecticut? You had a route there, too.
That's correct. We had a route in Connecticut. It was twice a week. That was also, I believe, in the 70s that we started to expand. We started to, I guess my dad and Joe started to bring additional jobbers into our company, and they had
As
employees, and they had what we call a book of business or customers, and these customers started to expand into Westchester, into Connecticut, and we grew.
So jobbers were becoming more like salespeople for Acme at that time.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, were there other smokehouses? Did each major city have their own smokehouse? Or was this, New York was the epicenter for smokefish?
It might have been the epicenter, but there were other smokehouses. There were two in Philadelphia. Not counting these little places that smoked whiting, there were several in New Jersey.
California?
New Jersey.
California. No, I'm saying, were there smokehouses in California as well?
There were two smokehouses that I knew of in Southern California. Lasco, who was a major smoker, bigger than any New York smoker. I forgot the name of the other.
And you also had a smoker in Chicago and one in Detroit and one in Cleveland.
And right. I'm sure the Pacific Northwest must have had many, many, many.
Right. A lot of small ones.
Which is still kind of the case out in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, yes.
A lot of small smokers up there. Doing a lot different, making a lot different product range than we make today. In New York, they're doing more of the hot smoked and the salmon candies and things like that.
Basically, it's all the same.
I think back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it was much more traditional, and some of the products they make there now may be a little different.
Right. So now Acme, we brought it up to the time where Acme starts to become one of the bigger players in the industry at this time in the... Or let's say 1980.
Yes, in 1980, there were, I'd say, four major smoke fish houses in the New York metropolitan area. It was Marshall, Acme, Vita, and probably Nova Scotia were the four larger ones. There was good competition.
By no means, though, was Acme the big guy in the group. They were probably the smallest of that group of... Mm-hmm. Of smokers. And Acme was never
definitely
the big one.
Definitely in the bottom half.
Right.
Still, like Detroit, we were over capacity, under capacity, underutilized.
Uh-huh.
There were always at least one too many. Someplace along the line, as I said before, I don't remember dates. But Vita became a public company, was bought out by Brown and Williamson, who...
It was a tobacco company, right?
Yes, who were owned by the British Tobacco. And while Vita was a profitable company at the time, they felt that the profit was inadequate for the investment. They built a huge plant in Philadelphia, which was too big for their requirements. And someplace along the line, a corporate decision was made to close down Vita.
Joe, you remember the huge plant they built in the Bronx, in the Hunts Point Market also.
Right.
That was also around the same time?
The same time, yes.
It was one of these deals where New York City would build the plant for you and you just paid, I don't know, a nominal fee in rent, but it was too big for them. They thought they would be able to absorb all the other smokehouses to put product through their plant. From that point on, once Vita closed, all the survivors did much better.
So it's now the we're getting into the 80s, and Acme's starting to get product a little bit more around the country. You're getting some distribution in other areas. You've got Baltimore. You're sending stuff out, you said, to the Midwest.
Florida was a big market for us in the late 70s and early 80s.
Okay.
We did nice business down there. We actually opened up a small distribution center in the late 70s with one of our past employees.
Right.
And that was... That led us into that market, but there was tough competition down there.
And what happened there at the time?
Well, there was a smoker. We left that. There was a smoker in Florida that was very strong called Florida Smokefish, and
a transplanted New York company that was
Oxenberg
Brothers.
Right, and we couldn't compete with them. It was difficult, or they were stronger than we were, and.
In that market,
that's correct.
Right, they were manufacturing down in Miami, and you were sending product down from here, and it's you're basically the jobber down there.
Correct.
Okay.
It's always been hard to distribute in a city where there's a hometown manufacturer, and the hometown company has a huge advantage. So,
right.
Some of our growth has really been a result of other companies either wanting to sell their businesses or going out of business in other markets, and us being able to pick up being the major producer in those markets or the major distributor in those markets.
Right. So, Robert, you must have had a point in time where you stepped back from this business and maybe had a moment where you where you sort of realize that Harry Brownstein, Joe Brownstein, my brother Eric, my dad Ruben, we built this smoked fish business, and we're here, and we're now a national brand, and my son works here. I mean, when did you sort of have that moment?
That moment probably came about 4 to 5 years ago, and you David and Richie and Adam have been here, but we stepped back, Eric and I stepped back and looked at where we started from, what kind of business I was. It was in the 1970s or in 1970 when I first came in, what it is today, how well it's run, how the intensity of the staff to do the right job for the customers is still there. It's definitely, we have that moment consistently, weekly. Very proud of what we see and how the next generation is carrying. Next generation and their supporting staff is carrying on this company.
Well, David, you certainly are now looked at by many people in the company as the new oracle of smoked fish, and it's been for you. Tell me about your start in the business.
I started 2 weeks after college, and I graduated in 1996. So I guess that's close to 15 years now, 14, 15 years. My first role in the company was trying to figure out what exactly they did there. And I laugh, but I spent the first 2 years by my Uncle Robert's side just sort of following him around. And I remember going home each day saying to myself that I don't actually do anything. I'm there for a long time. I'm there 12 hours a day. I'm tired at the end of the day. But I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. I feel like I'm not accomplishing anything. And as the years went by, and I learned, I guess, through the same kind of osmosis as the salmon do, I became more self-confident in what I did there, and was able to take on roles that both Robert and Eric really didn't have time to do. They were busy running the business, but the business was growing and it was expanding, and somebody needed to manage that expansion. And that's really where I found a niche first in the business, which was renovating the facility, integrating new products in, new equipment, all stuff that the company needed, but that frankly nobody had the time to do. So I was able to grab that role, and I was very lucky because the company was in a growth mode, whether it was on purpose or accidental, we're still not sure. But due to circumstances around us, competitors trying to perform some get-rich-quick schemes and sell their businesses, go public, we were very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time with the right attitude. And that attitude was just to go in each day, spend your 12 hours a day there, take care of the day's business, make sure the customers were happy, make sure the product was taken care of, and come back the next day. And by doing that and by having the just go to work each day mentality, we actually survived past a lot of our competitors. And in the end, we're able to take over some markets that we never thought we would be able to.
So today, whereas Joe described, we had about 15 smokehouses in the local area. Who's left? Who are the survivors?
In the New York area, there are a few left, but of much smaller size than Acme. Acme has really taken on a significant role. There's definitely still competition. You have some very stiff competition from some local suppliers, but the business has gone more national now, and there are a few major national competitors, but the local New York epicenter of smokefish has really changed and has been sort of distributed mostly to us, but also to other businesses in other parts of the country, and even to international competition, to South America, to Europe. They've been able to come in and bring products from overseas. So it isn't that there isn't competition. The competition is actually just as hard, or maybe harder, I mean, than it was years ago.
Uh-huh. What challenges does Acme face today?
Like I was saying before, really, the challenges are not as much from local manufacturing competition, but they're really how we can take our business and best help our customers. The customers are almost called partners now. They're no longer called customers. Our job is to help them sell their product. It's not just good enough to put the product on the shelves anymore. Now you have to help them. You have to help promote the product. You have to demo the product to consumers. You need to be concerned with your packaging and the retail face that you put on the street. So it's really a different business, and it's finding those right partner relationships between the retailer and the manufacturers now that sort of is the new trend in the food business. And it's been happening for the last 10 or 15 years, but if you look at some of the models out there, whether it be Whole Foods or Costco, the relationships are very much different now than they were 15 or 20 years ago.
What is the difference?
Did you say what is the difference?
Yeah, what is the difference in the relationship?
That's a good question. I think that the best way to describe it is that the bigger the retailer got, the more support that they need from the manufacturers and distributors to help them. They definitely need a support. Instead of being 15 or 20 stores, now they may be 300 stores. And it's the easier that we can make the buyer's job, I think the more they respect and appreciate what you can do. So although your price is important and, of course, your quality is important, there's more to it now than just price and quality. It's about being able to support them on a different level than before. Like you said before, there used to be just jobbers. Then you went from jobbers to starting to distribute your own products. Now you go from distributing your own product to helping them market the product at the store level. And I think that's the natural
progression.
The natural progression, and it's only going to get more, you know, sort of customer intense and customer specific.
And a lot of these retailers have a category manager that then has 300 deli managers that they've got to disseminate all this information to, and a lot of times it's our job, like you said, to educate them, and they still want to put out this authentic Brooklyn, New York product that on the scale that they're looking to do it, Acme fits in as the major provider, really probably the only provider who can be that authentic Brooklyn smoked fish and service a customer on that kind of scale right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're the largest at what we do in the New York area now, so it's incumbent upon us to help the customers and to provide that tradition that Joe and Ruben and Eric and Robert so nicely have been able to maintain for all these years. So it's our job now to make sure we carry on those traditions and are able to pass them not just as a retail smoked salmon to a customer, but as a whole story that goes along with it.
So what's today's product mix like compared to what Joe described earlier?
Staying in the New York area, you still have a lot of traditional style smoked fish. You still have a lot of these appetizing stores and delis or supermarkets with deli counters where they're going to slice the smoked fish for you. They're going to debone a whitefish for you, make you a whitefish salad, cut you a chunk of baked salmon, or slice you some sable. But we have a lot of those in New York, but there aren't as many of those as you move to the rest of the country. The rest of the country and other parts of New York, like supermarkets and club stores, they're really selling prepackaged product, much higher quality prepackaged product as the years have gone on.
Mm-hmm. Are there any species that we're smoking today that we weren't smoking years ago?
The biggest change is that the salmon that used to be smoked was wild salmon, whether it be from the East Coast of Canada, from the West Coast of Canada, from Alaska, from Seattle. It was all wild salmon. Somewhere in the, I'd guess, the late 80s, and really more strongly in the early 90s, farmed salmon became a small part and then a much larger part of what people actually eat. So today, if you're living in New York, there's probably a 90 or 95% chance that the salmon that you're eating is farm-raised salmon. So although it's not actually a different species. It's a completely different product than a wild salmon, a king salmon.
Where are the farms that you're getting salmon from?
Most of our product currently is purchased out of Norway, and also from Chile.
Mm-hmm. And what about the wild salmon? Is that a big part, or is it describe what our relationship is with wild salmon right now?
For us, wild salmon, it's important for us to give our customers and the consumers in the end an option on what they want. There are some people who are uncomfortable with farm salmon. There are some people who don't like the flavor or taste profile of wild salmon. So what we want to do is provide all of the options to our customers. So we'll sell a king salmon, a sockeye salmon, a coho salmon for wild options, and a farm-raised Atlantic salmon for farm salmon options. But realistically, there's not enough wild salmon to... If everybody decided that they would love to eat only wild salmon, you'd have a lot of hungry salmon eaters because there wouldn't be nearly enough quantity.
$50 a pound.
Yeah, your price would be $50, $100, maybe $200 a pound. Supply and demand. It's the growth. Farm-raised salmon has really accelerated the growth rate of salmon eating, not just as a smoked product, but as a cooked product. Buying a portion of salmon in a supermarket or fish store now is a very common, every day of the week product for people to eat.
So we're getting a variety of species of fish from all over the world. We're dealing with salmon companies, whether they're farmers or they're fishermen. We're dealing with the Great Lakes, folks who are going out and fishing for whitefish and for chubs. We've got wild cod that we're smoking, black cod from the West Coast. How do you deal with all of these different personalities and all these different, these are fishermen. These are guys who are actually going out and catching whitefish for you on a weekly basis, and you're getting them fresh. So how does that work for you?
Well, it's quite challenging. I mean, the different species require different personalities. So if you're buying whitefish out of the Great Lakes, you have one personality on. And if you're buying farm-raised salmon from a multinational 500 million or $1 billion company, you definitely have a different personality. You put your tie on, you put your sport coat on. When buying whitefish from the Great Lakes,
Who are you dealing with when you're... who's fishing for whitefish in the Great Lakes today?
You have a lot of Native American Indians. They're the ones with most of the licenses that are out catching the fish, and then they are selling it, literally selling it boatside to people who are processing them in their factories, or really huts. Uh-huh. And they're packing it with ice and shipping to us on a daily basis. So we are very, from a distance, we are very in tune with what's being caught every day in the lakes. I mean, I can tell you that there's a major storm brewing today in Michigan and causing a lot of damage, and all the fishermen are worried about whether or not their nets are going to survive today. Whereas I don't have that sort of day-to-day contact with farm-raised salmon out of Chile, right? You're buying massive quantities, doing year-long contracts, playing futures. Well, not playing, but purchasing futures, watching currencies. I mean, it's a totally different style of buying now. But again, it's species by species. So they all have one major concept though, which is supply and demand. No matter what it is you're buying, if there's not enough of it, the price is going to skyrocket. And if there's too much of it, you're going to be able to buy it at attractive prices.
I want to chime in that in Joe's day, the purchasing of salmon, just the salmon alone, was quite different. There was a salmon season of probably 3 months where Joe would travel to the West Coast and Alaska and secure the needs of Acme, the salmon needs of Acme Smokefish for the year. It was a short season, and he had to really hustle and have enough money to pay for all the salmon for the year.
So I heard a story once of a gentleman, Buzz Billick, who now works for us as our sales manager, about him going to Alaska, getting on these puddle jumpers with a briefcase full of cash and a revolver, looking for salmon, and that's how it was done.
Quite true.
Joe, you have a different story?
I use a semi-automatic.
I think Joe used a checkbook.
Yeah.
Actually, that wasn't quite that rugged.
Wasn't quite the Wild West. So stories, these are fish stories. They grow in scale just like my fishing stories from catching a bluefish in my kayak.
You mean that 3-pound one, Rich?
It was 10 pounds. I wanted to have a little fun also and sort of do a sort of lightning round and just go around and talk about some different terms for what we do. And our most common product is Novi.
Most of what we sell now is smoked salmon, but we still sell maybe 1% or 2% of the salmon we sell is mild cured lox, like the traditional West Coast salted salmon. That it's extremely salty compared to the smoked salmon that we eat today. So all of our customers still call up and say, give me 50 pounds of lox. And the joke in the office, of course, is that you need a permission slip. You know, you need your mom's permission slip in order to get lox from us.
Right. And my family is guilty of it as well. My family calls it lox, and they have not, in the last 15 years of me being in this business, I can't get anyone to change. So,
if I remember correctly, your grandfather called you the greatest lox chopper around.
Called me a lox chopper. And he's proud of it.
My expression is, or my belief or hope is, I don't care what you call it, just keep buying it from Acme.
That's right. You know, we have a few different processes that we live every day. What kind of smoking processes do we do at Acme?
There are two major processes. One of them is called cold smoking, where we take salmon, we fillet it, we cure it in a special recipe of salt and sugar. That product can stay in that solution for up to a week before it gets put in an oven. And when we say an oven, we're really talking about a room or a box that tries to keep a temperature of about 70 degrees Fahrenheit.
And humidity.
Right. So the idea is actually to just dehydrate the salmon, similar to how you would picture the texture of prosciutto. A dehydrated ham is salted and dehydrated. The same idea in smoked salmon. That creates that silky texture. That's what makes it sliceable and oily and delicious. The other process is a cooking process, what we call hot smoking. And that one it's completely unique. That there you're slow cooking, similar to a barbecue, and adding smoke to it. Both of them add smoke, but one at 200 degrees and one at 70 degrees. So the difference is, and the texture changes dramatically. The cooked product gets a flaky texture, and the dehydrated product or cold smoked gets an oily, silky texture.
Robert, Brooklyn, our neighborhood, we straddle Greenpoint and Williamsburg. How has the neighborhood changed in your time?
Oh boy, the neighborhood's changed tremendously in the time that I've been working there since 1970 or before. It was totally factories. Very few people on the street. Today, it's shops, apartment buildings. The streets are lively.
Restaurants.
The streets are lively day and night. It's a totally different neighborhood. It was all industry, all factories, I say, and now it's a neighborhood, thriving neighborhood.
We were on the border of two. I don't know the right word to describe it. The ethnicities. There were the Polish on one side, and the Sephardics and Puerto Ricans on the other side. And never the twain shall meet, I guess. That segregation, I don't see it now.
Yeah, it's a totally different neighborhood now. I mean, you have. It's become much more expensive neighborhood to live in. So that it's really gentrified a lot. It almost looks like you're walking through Soho, or the Village when you're walking in Williamsburg now.
I would guess you still have a high proportion of Polish women working in your slicing department.
We do, but they're starting to drift further and further away from the factory. We used to have probably, and just 10 years ago, I would guess that 80% of the people walked to work. Now, there are a lot more cars on the street and also a lot more subway riders. I mean, they're being pushed further and further from this area, which is, in some ways, it's beautiful for the area, and in other ways, it's sad to see because it's a change in history. I mean, Greenpoint was known as Little Poland, and now it's really changing, and it's becoming very expensive, and it's becoming very difficult to run a factory in an area where you don't have a lot of factory workers available.
And where people are living a lot closer to the factory now as well.
Yes, exactly.
Whereas, you know, different people.
Yeah. Scratch that.
Edit that part out, Nat, please. Thank you. So how much fish comes out of Acme on a daily basis?
I do better in weeks.
Weekly basis.
On a weekly basis, we probably produce, you know, somewhere in the range of 150,000 pounds of product per week.
That's what you produce. You sell more than that.
We're right. That's true. That's just on stuff that we produce. Then we have products that we have co-manufactured for us in other parts of the world. So, yeah, from a production standpoint, probably in the range of 100 to 150,000 pounds of product per week.
What percentage would you say of that 150,000? What percentage is salmon and percentage is other fish?
It's close to 50-50 now.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it would be more.
You thought the salmon would be higher. I think it was as of maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and as we've started to sell more and more whitefish products, actually over the last maybe 5 or 6 years, we've seen a real nice increase in whitefish salad and some other whitefish products. It's helped to even it out a little bit.
Is the customer base changing, or has it changed over the last 20 years?
We keep thinking that the customer base is going to change, but you know, we keep thinking as the older generation that's eaten smoked salmon as a much more traditional ethnic food changes, so will our business. But the reality is smoked salmon is such a delicious product, and so is whitefish salad. I mean, it's changing in terms of the volumes of certain species that we make, but in general, I would say smoked fish is a thriving product line. I mean, if you go to Europe, it's a centerpiece of a lot of meals. I mean, smoked salmon is, they probably sell 20 or 30 times as much smoked salmon per person in Europe as they do in the U.S. So as far as I'm concerned, we can only go up. It's a lot of people, we thought with the changing generations that our business would change for the worse, but the reality is it's just becoming a more mainstream item to eat. I mean, you don't have to be Jewish to eat smoked salmon.
What has changed is the percentage of prepared, yeah, as opposed to actually that you actually buy at the store that's sliced in front of you.
Right. Most people buy a prepared smoked salmon package, and the quality of these packages has improved dramatically, so that there is not as big of a difference as there once was between the two. For my money, I only bring home whole smoked salmon to slice myself, though.
I went to Harrods in London to look their foods, and they had sides of salmon piled up like it was a Berlin Wall about 10 years later. And of course, they were slicing it by hand. About 10 years or 15 years later, when I was there again, I had one salmon there. Everything else was packages. Same thing happened to you. Happened to them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And now, I mean, if you go through some of these factories in Europe, whether it be Poland or Denmark or Norway, I mean, they are massive facilities, very close to the raw material, very close to the Norwegian salmon. They get truckloads of fresh salmon in on a daily basis, and they run through this massive, I mean, we're talking about a very traditional product line that they take this product and they are able through equipment and assembly lines to produce really incredible quality packages. So it's everywhere you go in the world, there's something you can learn. Bring it back to where you do your work,
which is still different. Different from what Acme's doing, in that Acme sort of straddles that, you know, almost big box boutique, I like to call it. It still has the family influence and the history of this Brooklyn, New York smoked fish on a scale where we're able to produce for the masses.
Right. We are definitely not looking to make a assembly line factory. That's not our style. It's much more handcrafted, much more Brooklyn style.
Right.
Much like my bowling game.
Rob, you've always had a lot of great stories about the company and about business. Is there anything that sort of sticks out as like a real great funny story about smoked fish, or about Acme smoked fish, or your time in the business?
I'm sure there are many funny stories. I can't think of one right at this moment. David mentioned when the customers order lox. You know, we talk about a note from your mother before. I always just get a kick out of that. But the other story that I sometimes tell is when I'm calling for accounts receivable to a customer. My line that I often use is, we have a deal with our bank. They don't smoke fish, and we don't loan money, so please pay your bill.
Which rings true in 2010, and I'm sure will in the coming years.
I swear, every time I hear that one, I want to write it down. It's great.
I like when you tell it to the bank, when you tell it to our bank.
My father told me that one.
I'm going to tell it to my son one day.
So we're manufacturing smoked fish, and we're manufacturing jokes and humor and a real great sense of a family that's been involved in the fabric of the smoked fish business for probably 70 some odd years at this point, 80 years.
I think just one interesting tidbit. One of the things that is different about our family than some of the other sort of family smokehouses that have, or even other family businesses, is we've had great luck in continuity. We've had
the family relationship.
Yeah, and as my father says, it's, you know, success helps, but we've had a very good work ethic instilled from one generation to the next, and that is something that for me, there's a bit of luck involved in that. You don't know. In running a family business, what the next generation will be like. And you can only hope that you teach to them the way you were taught and that they are able to learn from you and yet still be able to grow and help to change the business in ways that it needs to. I mean, businesses change. They, from one generation to the next, they can't stay the same. They won't survive if they just do what the generation before did. But that work ethic that is instilled, that idea of coming to work every day, not trying to make a quick buck, but trying to be in there for the long haul, buying the right materials, producing the right way, not taking shortcuts, those things you can pass down. And those are, I feel very lucky to have been offered the opportunity to enter this business. Not everybody, you know, some people say, oh, you work so hard. And I say, I'm just the lucky one. I'm the one who got offered the opportunity. So it's, you know, we can only hope that for generations to come, they'll be that same attitude.
Like Eric Caslow has said many times, if you start with a high quality raw material, you at least have a decent shot of making a good product out of it. And that's what we try to do on a daily basis. We like to put out an honest, good product, that's not going to go for well, is it?
Well, you can apply that same theory to family. I look here and I see good product.
Right. Is there anything else that anyone wanted to bring up while we're here with this opportunity?
You asked Robert when He felt that he had it made. Those are not the words you use.
I didn't quite say that.
When Acme had it made.
When I had an aha moment.
I have a different point of reference. When we were able to pay our bills and use that fact to get additional supplies, which was always a problem for us, since most of the time we were inadequately financed. When I was able to pay my bills faster than my competitors, I knew we had it made. And to a fisherman on the West Coast, the speed at which he has to pay for the salmon that's landed daily or weekly, depends on the arrangement he has. And it may be several months before he's able to sell and be paid for what he sold me. If I'm in a position to expedite it, at one time we even advanced money to a man. Because we wanted to get his product. Prior to that, we were never in a position to do that.
So I've been sitting with the second, third, and fourth generations of Acme Smoked Fish, Joe Brownstein, Robert Caslow, and David Caslow. We've been talking about the history of Acme Smoked Fish and the smoked fish business in Brooklyn, New York. I hope everybody had a good time listening to it and learned something, and we hope to talk about smoked fish many more times here on Heritage Radio Network.
Why, there goes Jack Spratt, the poor sailor lad. He must go to sea once more.